The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Well, now we've had a mad week of Premier League managerial sackings, and it feels hard to think of a time before the cult of the manager. But we didn't always have managers in sport. And to take us inside how that all came about, Off the Ball managing editor Adrian Barry is on the line. Adrian, good morning.
Morning, Pat.
Managers are part and parcel of the game and part and parcel of the blame always as well. But when did it all start?
It's been such a mad week, hasn't it, Pat? And it just got me thinking, Maresca gone, Amorim gone, Frank on the brink, Slot under a bit of pressure. And it's become such a narrative and a part of our lives that it's hard to imagine a time where it wasn't always the case. But it wasn't. And funny enough, given the week that's been in it, it was English football that very much led the way on all of this. End of the 19th century, teams were becoming far more professional in the sense of obviously things that we take for granted now, particularly in terms of soccer. Things like payment for players, how clubs were run, sponsorships, prize money, all of that. So they'd become big business, and it didn't really suit to have them run by volunteers or part-timers.
So the idea that the committee would run the football club, like a committee might run a golf club at the moment or even a tennis club, that's the way those kind of sports still work. But a professional football club with serious income going in and out, obviously they wanted more professional. So what was the manager's job? Was it a business job or was it a coaching job when it started?
It was a little bit. It's a really good question because it was a little bit of everything. And I think if we focus on English football for the minute, because I think like you talk about stuff like committees, for example, and they were still very much in vogue. And you'll remember yourself, as I do, even in Irish rugby, international rugby, up to very recent times. But yeah, very much back in the day, it was a committee led thing. George Ramsay is a name that I've loved getting under the nails of this item over the last 24 hours, because there was some stuff that I was very familiar with and things I didn't know about, including the name of George Ramsay, Pat, who was a Scot, moved to Birmingham to work in a brass foundry at that time. This is the late 1800s. He had been out for a walk, had seen Aston Villa, you know, Ragball Rovers at that time, to all intents and purposes, training in a park. They needed somebody to make up numbers. He comes onto the pitch, has a load of silky skills, and they say, listen, you need to come and join us. And actually, that was turned out to be a really pivotal moment in the future of English football. There was a big Scottish connection there at the time, to the point where, if you can recall or Google the Aston Villa crest that has the great Scottish lion on it, that all came from the time around George Ramsay joining the club, and it remains there to this day. But George Ramsay himself becomes a great player for the club. People start paying in to see him. Villa are very much on the rise, and he gets injured at around about, I think, the age of 27. And he comes in, and you know what you're referring to in terms of the selection of the club and the running of the club, as the club secretary. And that was a huge role at that time. He's involved in all aspects of the club, including their move from amateur to professional in around 1885. There's an ad, Pat, that goes into a local Birmingham newspaper. Now, this ad is an iconic piece of history that no one could have predicted the ramifications of at the time. And the ad reads, wanted manager for Aston Villa Football Club, who'll be required to devote his whole time under direction of the committee, salary £100 per annum, the lofty sum. Applications with reference must be made not later than June 23rd to the chairman of the committee, Aston Villa Clubhouse, 6 Whitton Road, Aston. And thereafter, the world of management has changed.
So this was the very first professional football manager.
Correct. And funny enough, they advertised for the manager. Who gets the gig, Pat? Ramsay himself. he launched the phenomenon, I suppose, as the manager around that time. Listen, there was a bit of ambiguity even still. They did advertise for the manager. I think he might have been still referred to as the secretary for a while after that. But it really isn't a stretch to think that he was also, on the other side of an inspiration for that long association, as we well know, of Scots in English football. Yeah. And he came in on a term. We talk about, I don't know if you saw during the week, but Liam Senior gets a 6.5-year deal at Chelsea, and we all have a like really sharp intake of breath about the duration of this. It's, you know, it's phenomenal length. Ramsay took on a term, a tenure at Aston Villa for 40 years. would you believe?
Now, some of the greats, I mean, names spring to mind. You think of the Busby Babes, Matt Busby, and another Manchester United legend, of course, Alec Ferguson, Arsene Wenger. There are, you know, some names that still trip off the tongue as fairly long-lasting and significant managers. Who would you put in the, if you like, the top 10?
Well, you know, funny enough, like, I as I said, I wasn't familiar with the name of George Ramsay, but like his record is absolutely sensational, Pat. He won 6 league titles, 6 FA Cups, and he's still third on the overall record of titles in England behind Ferguson and Wenger. So he is absolutely right up there, and it's a shame that I hadn't known anything about him. But yeah, listen, you mentioned some of them there. Like, you can't get away from, you know, the likes of Pep. You have different managers in there at different points. Rinus Michels, often referred to as the godfather of football, people who changed the game. I think Pep is very much in that regard. And then you have the ones who just won a lot of trophies. Ferguson is there, Clough is there, Bob Paisley, Shankly. You can't forget about Matt Busby. Carlo Ancelotti has always won has won an awful lot. And also the Irish managers in England, Pat, like, we have somebody now who's literally, you know, he's pulling up trees at Brentford in the form of Keith Andrews. And we haven't had an awful lot of Irish managers, funny enough, in top jobs in England. Joe Kinnear, Dave O'Leary is there. Frank O'Farrell, of course, at United. Big Mick, Roy, his good buddy. Chris Hughton, Owen Coyle. Tiny number, really, when you think about it.
Now, let's talk GAA and the arrival of the manager there. And often the manager is surrounded by a bunch of selectors, but the manager is still very much the boss. Who's the original daddy of them all?
Well, do you know what? GAA, in every regard, is such a hard topic to look into, just from the pure fact of we are not very good at keeping stats and facts and details about this thing going back. So much harder to trace. But absolutely, as you say, great traditions in the game, like decades of selection committees, trainers. You know, at some point, as far as I can trace it, back to probably the 70s, what was happening across the water started to bleed into what was happening here. The channels, Pat, started to arrive. So people were looking at stuff like Match of the Day an awful lot more. They were looking at this manager stuff and starting to scratch their head and say there may well be something in it. Now, a couple of the most high-profile managers that the game has ever seen, it turns out, were certainly amongst the first two ever managers in GAA. It's widely thought, in fact, that Kevin Heffernan was probably the first of them all, in the sense of that kind of standalone manager, let's say, you know, with some power to run the team affairs. And like, did he do that, you know, in some regards? 7 All-Irelands across 10 years in 2 different spells as Dublin manager. And, you know, more so than that, like, we talked about people like Rinus Michels and Pep and people who changed the game. Like, Kevin Heffernan was very much that man. Yeah. You know, led a Gaelic football revolution in the city and the county that were, it's fair enough to say, were fairly disinterested in the sport up to that time, but he made it sexy.
Heffo's Army and all of that. Mick O'Dwyer, of course, in Kerry, you know, a contemporary of Heffo's for a lot of the time. Gerlach Nan and Clare, Brian Cody and Kilkenny in the hurling side. Now, finally, we go to rugby. Again, the committee was probably very important up to a point.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it seems like there was some evidence of coaches and managers in places like New Zealand, maybe as early as the 1900s, but it took us quite the amount of time to get up to speed with things here. It was the late 60s, really, before we had head coaches and the like of that. And, you know, even from an Irish point of view, Ronnie Dawson was the first Irish head coach, an Ireland hooker, a Lions captain. He only passed, actually, at the end of 2024 at the age of 92. We had various others until we moved it into, again, you know, people that we'll all be very familiar with, the Give It A Lash era of Mick Doyle in the 80s. And then the kind of the birth of professionalism was probably, you know, the time that we started to take it really seriously. And the first of the non-Irish coaches started to arrive. You had Murray Kidd from New Zealand in 95, fairly underwhelming tenure of Brian Ashton after that. Warren Gatland comes in after that. And in the modern era, actually, of professional rugby here, 30 years back, we've only had 2, would you believe, full-time Irish head coaches of Ireland in the shape of Eddie O'Sullivan and Declan Kidney. We did have Simon Easter before people start shouting at their radios. We did have Simon Easterby for the Six Nations last year, but he was technically an intern. Mm. So it's kind of remarkable when you think about it, in that period of time, just 2 Irish coaches.
And Kieran Fitzgerald was not that full-time Irish coach.
No. No, we had some interns in the, you know, that were filler inners, I suppose, but not on that full time.
So last question, Adrian, and briefly, if you could, do they make a difference? Does the quality of the manager help a team sink or swim? And we, Amorim is supposed to be a great manager, yet he's gone.
Yeah. You're asking me to be brief on this. I'll try. This is the great golden question. I think it probably depends a lot on where the club is. Like, if you look at the likes of Keith Andrews, who comes in with like little to no actual head coach, which is what his title is, experience, he fits into a club where all the structures are in place that, you know, let's say you or I, Pat, could go in there and we might do a decent job, and he has done that for sure. But I think it depends really on the context of the club you're going into. It feels to me like a club like Manchester United are often using the failures, and were that under Ruben Amorim, of the manager to buy themselves some time. So, you know, the cult of the manager, I don't think, is going anywhere anytime soon.
Adrian, thank you very much for joining us. That's Adrian Barry, the managing editor of Off the Ball. Now,
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.